It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 701 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, April 25th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. Had nightmares overnight about that Chris Weidman injury from the UFC show last night. Ugh. Ugh. But tonight, there is another pay-per-view. It is the Impact Rebellion pay-per-view featuring the winner-take-all main event, AEW champion versus the Impact champion Kenny Omega takes on Rich Swann. As far as a prediction, I think you know my prediction for this match. The only question is, when does Kenny Omega drop the Impact belt and to whom? I don't know the when. I certainly would not do it before he dropped the AEW championship, which shouldn't be for a while. But, yeah, I think back to January when Moose filled in for Alex Shelley in that six-man tag and how much he impressed me. And I think that when the time is right, depending on what's going on in Impact at that time, Moose might not be such a bad candidate to take that title off Kenny Omega. But again, after Omega drops the AEW championship to Hangman or whoever it is that he's going to lose it to, but the outcome tonight should not be in doubt. Kenny Omega is going to be a double champion, maybe a triple champion. How many belts does he have right now? Does he still have the AAA Mega belt? I believe he still does. Yes, Kenny Omega is going to win this match tonight. For those of you who missed it, I did a four-hour-long live stream last Sunday answering your questions, Sound Off Inbox Special Edition. Had a little party online celebrating 700 episodes of the podcast last weekend. I was not planning on going 4 hours, but there were a lot of questions, including some of your email questions. So if you had sent me an email question, you might want to check out that stream, because you never know if I answered it live on the air. So if you missed it, go back and check that out on YouTube. I also push the audio out to the feed. That's the feed, not the fiend. He's not doing much of anything these days. It's been a hot minute since I have had a big new wrestling book to tell you all about, but former WWE champion, perhaps soon to be again WWE champion, Drew McIntyre, has a new book coming out on May the 4th. May the 4th be with you, called A Chosen Destiny, My Story. And you can pre-order your copy right now in audiobook form for free. Over 8 hours of audio narrated by McIntyre himself. You can use our Audible link to pre-order the book before it drops and listen to the entire thing at no cost to you with a 30-day trial of the service. Just go to audibletrial.com/Solomonster. That is the place to go to sign up. Make that your one free audiobook. Because when you start one of these trials, you got 30 days to sample the service. You get one free book that you get to keep no matter what. A lot of you did the same thing for the Young Bucks book when it came out. You seemed to enjoy it. I mean, I saw reviews online from people who aren't even really fond of the Young Bucks who enjoyed their book. And you can get that one if you want. But take advantage of this offer while you can. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Every time you do, you help out the podcast. So I thank you. You can make a PayPal donation if you'd like. thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. And here on 701 this week, as we begin our journey to 800, I must say thank you to the Angel of Anarchy, Lucas Kroll, with a bomb. Dropped a bomb on me this week, so thank you to Lucas. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Bryant Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Shout out to Mama Eichert. I saw the photo that Willie posted on Twitter before I started recording here of his mother wearing a Sound Off shirt. So I hope the both of them are doing well. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. Ostentatious Alan Carter. The Alabama Assassin, Chris Young. The Billings Badass, Jacob Harris. Eric First Blood Fisher. Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd. Powerful Pierre DeGagne. The Dublin Destroyer, Robert Cummins. Doomsday, Zachary Gonido, first time donator, shout out to Zach. And Jake the Snake Harrison. Jacob turns 30 this weekend, and I want to wish him a very happy birthday. He's moved cross country 3 times since he has started listening to this podcast in 2017, and the one thing that follows him wherever he goes has been this podcast. So, Jacob, I hope it's a great one. Shout out to all of our new channel members on YouTube. In case you didn't know, you can become a channel member. There are 2 membership tiers on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolemonster. Please go and check that out. I'm working on a whole bunch of new content for channel members. There'll be more retro audio going up for our top tier. And for all members, I'm going to be working on a members-only Q&A. Plan to do a whole bunch of mini versions of this. The post is already up if you are a community member, so you can submit questions for me to pull from. That is up on the community tab if you are a member. And some other fun stuff planned that you may be seeing later this week. So if you choose to do so, I thank you. We are moving in the right direction. That is always good to see. The AEW Dynamite show from Wednesday, I want to mention here, there was a drop-off in the ratings, which you kind of figured there would be. Second biggest rating they ever did the week before. That was the first week unopposed. On a Wednesday night, they did over 1.2 million viewers. They were down this week to a little over 1.1 million viewers. So the fact that they were still up above a million is a great sign. The demo was down too, but not by much. I am most interested to see the number for the Blood and Guts match next week with the Inner Circle taking on the Pinnacle, because they're promoting it hard, as they should. Does it translate into a record-high audience? It's going to be an experiment because they're making it a one-match show. It's kind of sounded that way from the commentary on Wednesday when they said it's a one-match event. I wasn't sure if they literally meant there was only going to be one match featured on the show. It appears that is the case. And they're also upping the seating capacity to 50%. Outdoors at Daily's Place for the show with pod seating. That's according to the Daily's Place website. We're going to find out the rules this Wednesday. We know there will be a roof on the cage because the graphics that they have been posting on social media for selling tickets show a roof. So I'm all in favor of that. I always feel like War Games should have a cage. You know, in NXT, they have no roof, Triple H has said, to allow the talent to do moves and dives from the top of the cage. But really, you know, when I think of War Games, which is what this is their version of War Games, you're meant to be trapped inside. You're trapped inside like animals. That's kind of the whole point. Just raise the roof so you don't have a Brian Pillman situation when Sid almost killed him back in, 91, I think, in the War Games match. And it looks like that's what they're doing. They'll have a roof on it. It's going to be interesting to see, audience-wise, and even just the flow of the show. If they're literally only having one match, do they occupy, you know, one of the hours with video packages? How is this going to work? I don't know, but we're going to find out more of the rules on TV this week. WWE reported its first quarter earnings on Thursday with $263 million in revenue, over $43 million in profits. Well more than what analysts were expecting, largely from the initial lump sum payment they got from Peacock for the network. Vince McMahon said very little, which seems to be the norm on these things now. He took no questions, but here is what he did have to say. He said, "We're coming out of COVID. At first, we were in survival mode, but we found life. Once we felt secure, we then saw this as an opportunity to rethink the way we do business and open what I call the WWE treasure chest. The only way you're going to do that is with the best management team in WWE history. We have that team, a team that is innovative and drives revenue and has reorganized our company in a far more efficient way to take advantage of new revenue streams, new online platforms, new consumer products, content creation, and new opportunities to expand our media rights portfolio on a global basis. I'm always excited about our business. I don't think I have ever been as excited as I am now. They also talked about returning to live touring sometime in the second half of the year. I already told you the belief is they want live fans for SummerSlam. That is the goal. And I presume live events would then follow. The person who handled the majority of the call and the Q&A was their new president, Nick Khan. You've been hearing his name quite a bit, I'm sure. He's been making a lot of moves lately, including the Adnan Virk move on Raw, and wielding a lot of influence within the company. Vince McMahon has put a lot of faith and trust into this man. You know, and the more I hear about Nick Khan and all the moves he's making, this guy's going to be the one to sell this company to Comcast, which owns NBC Universal. I am, with each passing week, I am more and more convinced of this, that he is going to be the man. And maybe that's why he was brought in. Maybe that's part of the reason why he was brought in, to kind of clean things up, organize things in a better way, and get this company prepped and ready in the next, I don't know, five years or so to be sold. I am more and more convinced of this with every passing week when I hear about the moves that this man is making and the influence that he apparently has. And there were a lot of front office departures this week to that point, especially on the talent relations end. One of the names that surprised me was Joe Villa. Not that I knew him. I knew of him. I interacted with him a handful of times over the years. And he had been with the company over 20 years. He started out in fan services. He moved up to a top spot in their publicity and PR department. John Cohn, who serves as a referee, he was also a senior manager in talent relations. He was terminated in that managerial role. He was said to still be a referee. PW Insider later reported that this termination was rescinded already. His termination as a senior manager was already rescinded. And he is back in that role once again, working under John Laurinaitis, who recently returned to the role as head of talent relations. One person who is no longer working in talent relations, in fact, he is no longer working for WWE at all, is Mark Carano of Total Divas fame. Mark Carano. Wrestling Inc. was first to break the news of his departure, which came after Mickie James, who was one of the 10 talents fired by WWE a week earlier, received a special delivery at her home from WWE with some of her belongings, delivered in a garbage bag. This has become Garbage Gate. Big controversy this week. Mickie posted a photo on social media Thursday of said garbage bag with the caption, "Dear at Vince McMahon." So she tagged the boss. "I'm not sure if you're aware, I did receive my WWE care package today. Thank you. # always blessed and grateful. # women's wrestling matters." There were said to be other female performers who also had their belongings returned to them in a trash bag, but Mickie is the one who went public with it. One female talent told The Observer, "We have drawers that travel as well as bringing stuff from home to the shows. So we leave little things we may need from week to week, our gear, our makeup, our shoes. We take our gear bag home, but a lot of people have heavy gear that is easier to leave at the venue." And then I presume the company just transports it for them, place to place. Gail Kim, Maria Kanellis, and Jillian Hall all chimed in. They said the same thing happened to them. And, you know, in the case of someone like Jillian or Gail Kim, they haven't been with the company probably for a decade or more. So if this was happening to them, that was years ago. That probably predates Carano's role, I'm sure, in talent relations. I think Carano may have been with the company long before that, but not in a talent relations role. So they needed a scapegoat. Carano was that scapegoat. I see tweets and all kinds of things online implicating Carano. Oh, he's a creepy guy. There's some woman on social media throwing stories around about him. I think it's the same woman who used to be. You know what? I'm not even going to get into all that because who knows what's real and what's not. Anybody can go on Twitter and throw around accusations. I don't know Carano personally. I know of what I saw of him on Total Divas the two or three times I watched that show at the beginning. And he didn't come across as, an overly likable guy. But I don't know much about him on a personal level. In this case, whether or not he was doing all of those things is irrelevant. They needed a scapegoat. And Carano was that scapegoat. I mean, it's all about appearances. You're firing these people. At least put their stuff in something other than a goddamn hefty bag. Nobody thought of the symbolism of that. Within hours of Mickey posting that photo, WWE took action, with Triple H and John Laurinaitis posting virtually identical tweets, saying, upon learning of the disrespectful treatment of some of our recently released talent, on behalf of the company, we took immediate action. The person responsible for this inconsiderate action has been fired and is no longer with WWE. That person being Carano. Stephanie McMahon tweeted, I am embarrassed that you or anyone else would be treated this way. I apologize personally and on behalf of WWE. The person responsible is no longer with our company. Mickey later responded to Stephanie and said, thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate that as I am equally embarrassed. I know this wasn't a malicious act. However, it did feel very symbolic to how I was presented in the last 3 years. Like I said, it's the symbolism of it. I doubt that Triple H or Stephanie or Vince or any of the top people even knew it was happening. You'd think Vince McMahon and Triple H are brought into the decision-making on what kind of fucking bag to put people's belongings in. They don't know this shit's going on. Now, you could say they should know. They should have been aware. But those are decisions that are below their pay grade. So I'm sure they didn't know it was happening. They've got more important things to occupy their time with. But these are the sorts of things, you know, in the age of social media that will come back to bite you on the ass. You know, my take on the whole thing? They were probably getting rid of Carano anyway. This just gave them a good excuse to give him the boot. I mean, think about it. The minute they reinstalled John Laurinaitis in a talent relations role, he basically took Carano's spot. He took his job. At that point, I wasn't even sure they were going to keep Carano around anyway. They no longer had any use for him. So I think it's very likely with that whole wave of departures last week, he would have been a goner anyway. He would have been among the names that were probably going to be let go. But this just gave them this perfect reason, very publicly, to give him the boot. All of this gives new meaning to a garbage move on WWE's part. But now we can move on from Garbage Gate because there are far more important things to talk about. Case in point, and this is a really sad story. Steve Mongo McMichael, who played a key role in the Chicago Bears winning their one and only Super Bowl in the 1985 season. Later on, he had a stint in WCW as a member of the Four Horsemen. He went public this week to announce that he has been diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, named after the famous New York Yankee who had his baseball career, really his life, cut short by the illness. The Ice Bucket Challenge, everybody remembers that? The Ice Bucket Challenge a few years ago that went viral, that was intended to bring about a greater awareness of ALS. If you read up on it, if you know anything about it, if you know anyone who has had ALS, it is a sinister illness. I mean, it robs you of your ability to eat, to speak, to move, to breathe until you just die. It's about as horrible as any illness that is out there. I mean, not that anybody wants any kind of illness. I mean, there's a lot of really terrible, you know, diseases out there and cancers and all kinds of shit. But I would say on the list or on the bingo card of horrible illnesses, this has got to be up there in the top two that I certainly would never want to have. And there's no cure for it. There's no known cure. They're you know, working on certain medications and things that can slow the progression. In the case of McMichael, this is happening very, very quickly. His body is failing on him at a rapid rate. Just a horrifying diagnosis. And he is making the announcement now to let everybody know that he is retiring from public life. We will not be seeing him make any more public appearances. He can't sign autographs anymore anyway because he has no use of his hands. And I guess he had a radio spot talking about, you know, Bears football in Chicago, and there was a band that he played with. And so he just wanted to let people know so they're not wondering, hey, what happened to Mongo? Where's he at? He figured, let's just go public. We'll bring some awareness to this, but I want people to know why they're not going to see me anymore. You know, he's using a specialized wheelchair now to get around, although he's not yet completely reliant on it, but he will be very soon. It's very expensive, though. So the family has set up a GoFundMe while they wait on money that they should be getting from the NFL. The NFL has a plan that is set up to provide financial assistance to retired players for diseases just like this, ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. A lot of retired football players unfortunately end up being diagnosed with conditions like this. But once they're approved, my understanding is that they should end up with over $140,000. The problem is they have no idea when they'll be approved. It could be a while before they get their hands on that money. And in the meantime, the medical bills are piling up. You hear about stories like this in this country all the time. You could easily be bankrupted just by medical bills. So they're running through their savings. They have to find a new home that is handicap accessible. I guess they rent their current home, so they can't make any renovations to it because they don't own it. So they're looking to move. It's a whole situation. He was diagnosed officially in February. He had been having issues, I guess, for months before. He had tingling in his arms and such, but he just figured it stemmed from the wear and tear of playing football and his wrestling career. But he's only been given a few years to live. He's got a 13-year-old daughter at home. It's just, you know, God, it's, and he's not that old. He's in his early 60s, I believe, but he's got a 13-year-old kid at home. I mean, it's tough, but he's keeping a good attitude about it. His wife, Misty, has been a godsend for him, taking care of him as best she can. Some people may forget Mongo was in WWE before he was ever in WCW. He didn't wrestle. You know, everybody knows about WrestleMania 11, LT and Bam Bam in the main event, but Mongo was one of the NFL All-Stars in Lawrence Taylor's corner for that match. But even before that, in the build-up, he had done commentary for a King Kong Bundy match on an episode of Monday Night Raw. And later that same year, when WCW Monday Nitro debuted on TNT from the Mall of America, he was part of the announce team, along with Eric Bischoff and Bobby Heenan. Later on, he got into the ring. It was Mongo and Kevin Green. Kevin Green just passed away in December. I think he was even younger than Mongo. The two of them took on Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, and Mongo turned on Kevin Green and joined the Horsemen. And he was married to Deborah at the time, who was later married to Steve Austin. But he had a decent run there. He wasn't the best wrestler, but he looked the part. He was very charismatic. I know there's an entire Twitter account dedicated to Mongo moments and botches. He was very entertaining, I'll say that much. Not too many people can say they have an entire Twitter account, you know, dedicated to them and their moments. However bad some of them may have been. But when asked by the Chicago Tribune whether or not he would do it all over again, if he could, knowing that his football career could have played a role, or even his wrestling career, even if that meant ending up with ALS, he said, hell yes, I would do it all over again, because it is not about the destination, it's about the journey in getting there. But I wish him well. There isn't really much else to say. You kind of know what the outcome is going to be. It's not going to be good. But I wish him well. Some other sad health news. EC3 posted a photo on social media of himself laid up in a hospital bed fighting off some kind of infection. He said, short version, an infection I neglected proper care for, put others' people's needs before mine, caught up to me and broke me. Long version, it's extensive. I've been hospitalized 5 days and will need longer. I will heal. If you want to help, drop a comment or a thought or affirmation. Please do not text. All I ask, if you want to help, let me be alone. So get well soon to EC3. I hope it's not a staph infection. Those could be nasty. And per this week's Observer, Conan, who just got over a rough time with COVID, learned this week that he is in need of a second kidney transplant. He already had one kidney transplant back in 2007. The wait list in California, which I guess is where he lives, is very long. It could be many years to wait for a new kidney, and so he is thinking about going to Mexico to have it done. Man, you know, I read through all these stories, and I always say it, take care of yourself, because if you don't have your health, you don't have a damn thing. Health is wealth. It's true. Sounds kind of corny, but it's true. Health is wealth, man, and I don't care how much money you have. I don't care how big of a star you are. I don't care what you've got going on in your life. If you don't have your health, none of it means shit. CM Punk has been making the media rounds to promote his role on Stephen Amell's new wrestling show, Heels, and his role as a police deputy in a new horror film called Jacob's Wife. And he had an interesting response to a challenge issued by the new IWGP World Heavyweight Champion, Will Ospreay. In his first press conference as champion, Ospreay called out Punk, saying, "Before I was champion, a man who sparked a whole lot of interest in pro wrestling, CM Punk, said that he would like to face Will Ospreay. Now I have the biggest prize in pro wrestling, so if you really want to prove that you were the best in the world and not the best of a bad bunch, come over here and try and take this." Punk talked to Digital Spy and had this to say about Ospreay's comments. "I don't want to give people false hope in answering Ospreay, but he's for sure somebody that I have never wrestled before that interests me a lot more than, I guess, the corporate side of professional wrestling nowadays. New and different things are going to interest me more than doing the same old, same old. I always need new goals. I don't know. Let's see if he has it at the end of the summer and then ask me the question again." Speaking to Sports Illustrated, Punk added this about a possible return to the ring. He said, "I don't need the money, and the way the wrestling business is now, it's wacky. You've got WWE, who has multiple billion-dollar television deals, and the television's awful. I go back there, I'm just another guy, and it's not even that. I would be just another guy that's doing not good television. I want to do stuff that's good. I want my name attached to quality projects where it's fun, and it makes people laugh, smile, think, and people don't hate watch. I want to do fun stuff." You know, people have asked Punk the question many, many times over the years. Are you going to come back? When are you going to come back? Would you go to WWE? Would you go to Japan? Would you go to AEW? And he's never said no. He's kind of like Steve Austin in that way. Austin never closed the door until recently. Now he does. But for years, Austin was smart. He left the door open for people to think that there was a chance that he might come back and wrestle, even though in his mind, he probably knew, "I'm not coming back." You know, once we got past the 10-year mark, it was probably pretty much a done deal that Austin wasn't going to come back, let alone now. I mean, we're coming up on 20 years of Austin not wrestling. He ain't coming back. But Austin would say, "Well, you know, never say never. And, you know, if I wanted to, I'm sure I could get another 2 or 3 year run out of me. And, you know, if I physically, I feel great, I could come back and wrestle." So he gave people a lot of false hope sometimes by saying that, even with Punk when they had the video game promotion for 2K, what was it, 2K11 it might have been? That great segment, that sit down with Jim Ross. I mean, if that didn't get you excited for a Punk Austin match, then nothing would. So Punk is kind of doing the same thing. You know, when he was on Renee Young's podcast not too long ago, he was more open in that interview than ever before talking about a potential return. He said, "Look, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't know." He goes, "I'm open to it." He even sounded open to going back to WWE, but there would be some, you know, repairing that would need to be done to those bridges. I don't think that Punk has closed the door to a ring return. I really don't. And I think he absolutely could come back. I think a CM Punk Will Ospreay IWGP title match at the Tokyo Dome with the hype behind it would do big business. You know, if their New Japan World subscription skyrocketed for Jericho coming in to face Kenny Omega, I think the first big Punk match in 7 or 8 years would be just as big. Now, I know that Jericho already had a name in Japan and Punk doesn't. He doesn't have the experience working there that Jericho did. But if I'm New Japan, if I'm hearing that answer, I mean, yeah, he could be stringing people along just to keep him talking, and it's smart of him to do that if he is, but if he's being serious, and I work for New Japan and I hear that, come August or September, if Ospreay is still the champion, I've got it marked down on my calendar to reach out and say, hey, you want to do this? Let's make it work. What's it going to take? I think if Japan can get to a point with COVID, because they're imposing more lockdowns now over there, it's getting kind of bad again. If they can get past all of that, coming out of this, however many more months it takes, if there's an attraction similar to Jericho and Omega that they think they could realistically put together, that they think would really spike interest and spike business, then they have to do it. They have to at least try. The match itself could be very good, whatever you think of Ospreay. I mean, he's a tremendous in-ring performer. He's one of the best in the world. You know, with Punk, he used to call himself the best in the world, but you don't know what you're going to get. He's 42 years old, and aside from maybe a few surprise shots at random indie shows under a mask that he's been rumored to have done over the years, as far as we know, he hasn't wrestled a match since 2014. But it would be a huge attraction for, say, Wrestle Kingdom 2022. And if you don't like Ospreay, you don't like Punk, that's fine. But, you know, if you're a smart person, you put that aside and realize that, you know, that could do some big business. And if you don't at least make the effort, then you'll never know if you can make it happen or not. I think the success of the Jericho and Omega match should have New Japan, you know, putting some kind of plan in place to, in a few months, see if Punk is being serious or not. Let's talk about Monday Night Raw. You know, when I was talking about Adnan Virk last week, I said that I wasn't sure if he came into this a wrestling fan or not. He appeared on the Ryan Russillo podcast, and when Russillo said that he has no memory of Virk ever bringing up wrestling when they used to work together, Virk said, look, I'm not going to lie and tell you that I'm watching Raw and SmackDown every week. I've got four kids. I'm doing baseball stuff, college sports. He said he went on WWE.com to learn about Shayna Baszler's history and what her finishing move is. I don't know if that was before or after he called her move a Karafuta driver instead of a Karafuta clutch. I mean, look, we all make mistakes with names sometimes, but a driver implies dropping someone on their head, and the other is a submission hold. Those are two totally different things. He also admitted that there is the potential for this to end up going really poorly, but he's not worried because he's got other options, and if it does go poorly, he says, it'll make for a great story to tell. He has finally met Vince McMahon, by the way. He was on Boomer Esiason's radio show. He said he met Vince after his second show this past week, and McMahon gave him good feedback. You know, I said last week, this guy ain't going to last, and I still feel that way. I don't know how many months it'll be. I don't see him having a long-term future in this role. The one thing that works to his advantage, I guess, is the fact that we've learned that he is a Nick Khan guy. Nick Khan used to be his agent. Nick Khan is the one who brought him in and made the recommendation to bring him in. And if Vince McMahon is very happy with the moves that Nick Khan is making and doesn't want to piss him off or rock the boat and wants to kind of let him have the autonomy to do his thing, you know, Virk being a Nick Khan guy would probably buy him some more time, but I still don't see him lasting in this role. Maybe he'll grow into it, and a year from now he'll sound, you know, it'll be a total 180. I don't see it. But he'll probably have a little bit of a longer leash because of who brought him in. But according to Fightful, Vince McMahon showed up very late to the show on Monday. He made a bunch of changes. They had been advertising a first-time-ever match between Randy Orton and Braun Strowman, which did not happen. Instead, we got Orton against Matt Riddle, which was a better match than Orton and Strowman would have been, I'm sure. Orton definitely dinged his shoulder on a power slam early in the match. He was favoring it. He barely used his arm the rest of the way. I've seen nothing, though, about an Orton injury. They gave Riddle the shock win. He crucifixed Orton into the pin, and they sold it like it was a major upset, which, you know, is a little weird given that the guy was just the United States champion, but They tried to get it over as a big deal. Look, they did the same for Keith Lee when he beat Randy Orton back at Payback in September. You know, for Riddle's sake, I hope he has better luck than Keith Lee has had. Although Keith Lee has other issues beyond the booking that are keeping him off of television. We had T-Bar and Mace once again attack Drew McIntyre, which led to a handicap match later in the show. T-Bag and Mace were disqualified for kicking McIntyre's ass in the corner and ignoring the referee's count. That brought out Braun Strowman for the save. That led to an impromptu tag team match with McIntyre and Strowman against Retribution. McIntyre ripped off Mace's mask. You know, Mace was the only one who actually looked kind of cool with the mask on, but even still, it was time. It was beyond time for something like this to happen. Drew beat on him with the mask until the referee called for the bell. Strowman ripped the mask off T-Bar. Neither man was referenced by their former names. Everyone had to play dumb and pretend to not know who they are. And I can almost excuse it with Dijak because he was never on the main roster. But Dio Madden was literally an announcer on this very show. I know he didn't last long, but it wasn't that long ago. Dio Madden was an announcer on Monday Night Raw, and they had to just completely ignore the fact that they even knew who this fucking guy was. But T-Bar and Mace have been unmasked, and hopefully this can now mark a fresh start for the both of them. I read that Mia Yim has been relocated to the SmackDown roster, which makes me wonder if Keith Lee is SmackDown bound when he comes back. Keith Lee against Daniel Bryan, Keith Lee against Roman Reigns, those are matches I would not mind seeing. Although it doesn't sound like the Bryan match is going to be happening. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Slapjack has also been moved to SmackDown, but as I said on the Dynamite stream during the Super Chat, somebody asked me a question about this. Slapjack is doomed. With or without the mask. I mean, he's done. He was doomed the moment they called him Slapjack. But even as just Shane Thorne, he has no future in this company. He came to NXT as a tag team wrestler, and when his partner left to go back home, he was doomed. You know, moving him from one roster to another will not make a lick of difference. For the second straight week, the Viking Express Experience Raiders, just throw all the names in there so I get it right, beat Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander. In case people missed it the week before, you know, they had to do the same fucking match 2 weeks in a row. They could have just replayed that match. Why even send these four back to the ring for a rerun? Adnan Virk referred to the Vikings finish as the Viking Express, which he also did last week. It makes me wonder if they changed the name, except that Corey Graves corrected him on the replay and referred to it as the Viking Experience, only for Virk to refer to it as the Viking Express again, even after Graves corrected him. What is he looking at on WWE.com? He says he's going on WWE.com to do his research. I think he needs to stop doing that. Where is he getting this information from? I'd like to know. Naomi and Lana, they got a win over Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler when Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke came out mid-match to show footage of Nia slipping and falling off the ring apron the week before. And this enraged Nia Jax, who chased after them, leaving Shayna all by herself to eat a facebuster and get pinned. Yet another pinfall loss for Shayna Baszler. At least it was Nia who got pinned on SmackDown. But the only saving grace to all of these pins and what happened on Raw and SmackDown this week, you know, I look at Baszler and all the pinfall losses that she has suffered. Baszler is in a close race with Bray Wyatt for that eater of pins name that I gave him. The only good thing about all of this is that it means, hopefully, the end of this team very soon. Later on backstage, Baszler told Nia, you know, you need to focus or else. And then as she walked away, Angel Garza showed up and asked Nia what she sees in that circus clown Reginald. Oh, God. Garza is going to be jobbing out to the Cirque du Soleil guy, isn't he? Isn't he? First they make him cut his hair for no reason. And now this. Alexa Bliss, she was on her swing set with Lily the Doll, sitting on the swing next to her. Bliss said that she and the doll have been best friends for a very long time. And they aired photos of Alexa as a child with a doll photoshopped into the pictures. Bliss, she remembered a girl being mean to her on the playground and refusing to give her a bite of her ice cream. And she said that she shoved that little bitch right off the swing, causing the girl to fall and break her arm. And then she said she got to eat all of the girl's ice cream. Let that be a lesson to all you kids out there. If someone doesn't want to share their ice cream with you, just shove that bitch to the ground and take it. Bliss said that when her teacher asked her why she did that, she told them that Lily made her do it. And Bliss warned the girls on the Raw roster that Lily did not like the Fiend, and she does not like any of them either. I am torn on this. Alexa does a tremendous job with it, but are we to believe? And I know really for this entire thing, we just need to just pretend that we're living in some kind of fantasy world, but are we to believe that Alexa has always had a creepy doll telling her to do evil things to people, even before the Fiend corrupted her? I thought the whole idea was she was just plain old Alexa Bliss, and then the Fiend got a hold of her, and the Fiend is the one who corrupted her, and now she is the Fiend. Why am I even trying to make sense of any of this? I'm talking about a woman on a swing set and her possessed puppet friend. Why am I even trying to make sense out of any of this? Asuka beat Charlotte Flair in the main event with a crucifix pin after Rhea Ripley, who was ringside watching the match, got involved. She reached into the ring, yanked Charlotte's arms out from underneath her while she had Asuka in the figure eight. And while she was distracted, Asuka got the win. After the match, Charlotte beat up the referee. She has since been indefinitely suspended and fined $100,000 for assaulting a WWE official. That seems to be the go-to amount whenever you put your hands on a referee. Remember years ago, Sheamus, I think, bro-kicked a referee. And I think John Laurinaitis, you know, fined him $100,000. They always throw these big amounts out there. Actually, you know what? I take that back. It might have been more. It might have been $500,000. I could be wrong. It might have been 500,000. I remember it being such a ridiculous number, though. I'm like, all right, you want to suspend the guy, you want to fine the guy, but don't come up with these dumb numbers. 100,000, that's not too bad. But the real reason that this whole suspension angle took place, per Alex McCarthy of TalkSport, is because Charlotte is having some dental surgery done and is going to be out for a little while. And this caused a bit of an uproar this week involving comments made by Dave Meltzer on Wrestling Observer Radio. He was talking about the fact that Charlotte would be taking time off for dental surgery, and this is what he said. She's just having a complete makeover, you know? That's just basically what's happened, so it's one of those things, you know? They make you real subconscious about your looks when you're a woman in wrestling, and it's just one of the negatives about it, but it is a reality of it. And someone clipped the comment and posted it on Twitter and tagged Charlotte. She listened to it and she wrote this. Yeah, I just listened. I thought Dave Meltzer would have learned his lesson the last time commenting about women's bodies, but apparently I'm fair game. So I get to respond again. To a rumor about my body. Again. You know what? This is when I stop. Dave, go to hell. You have my phone number. It would take you 30 seconds to ask as opposed to giving straight crap to your listeners. Grow up. For you, of all people, to comment on a woman's looks. Do you have any shame, decency, or professionalism left at all? Find a mirror. Look hard, Dave. If Meltzer is speculating on why she is having dental work done, then he should have kept those comments to himself, because it is not relevant to the conversation. Yes, the fact is, Charlotte looks very different than when she did when she first got called up to the main roster. And yes, there are a lot of women in WWE over the years who have changed their appearance to look a certain way. Anyone with two functioning eyeballs can see that. And plenty of men, too, by the way. It is a cosmetic business. The Rock wore a tracksuit for a few months after he had gyno surgery. This was 20 years ago. Roman Reigns came back last year with veneers. Everybody was talking about it for like a week. Jerry Lawler. Have you seen Jerry Lawler's face? I mean, fuck, have you seen Vince McMahon lately? He looks like something that should be standing in Madame Tussauds. Just this week, there was a whole Twitter hashtag dedicated to Zac Efron and whether he got Botox treatments because his face looks different. I don't know, he looks the same to me, but then again, I don't study photos of Zac Efron all day. Who gives a shit if he did? I wish I could Botox these people's tongue muscles so they would shut the fuck up. Or their fingers so they would stiffen up and they couldn't type. Dave says he was trying to make a larger point about how much more tough it is for women in wrestling when it comes to the sexism and the misogyny, which is true. He's not wrong in saying that. Never forget the AJ Lee story about being told by the head of talent relations in WWE that the higher-ups there thought she was ugly and unfuckable. That's what she said, the exact words were. That she was unfuckable. And I guess, therefore, she would never get over. You think that's the only story of something like that happening? She is not the only one who has had stories to tell that when you hear them would make you very angry if you did. It is a very real problem. He is not wrong in pointing that out. I just don't see how Charlotte taking a few weeks off for her teeth had anything to do with that, necessarily, and needed the expanded commentary from Dave Meltzer. Maybe she's getting her wisdom teeth out. Who the hell knows? Or better yet, who the hell cares? Live and let live. But seriously, what is going on with Vince McMahon? Can we have a conversation about that? What in the world is going on with Vince McMahon's face? Let's get off this and talk about SmackDown Week 2 of Pat McAfee on commentary. And again, I thought he did well. I know that he didn't think he did well in Week 1. He was very hard on himself. Sure, I understand. Alexa, I am not talking to you. Would you shut the fuck up? Thank you. I know he didn't think he did well in Week 1. He was very hard on himself. But he was more of a natural fit than Verk is on Raw. This was one of those weeks where SmackDown was just on. They had a focused story for the duration of the show with Cesaro and Daniel Bryan waiting on an answer from Roman Reigns if he would defend the Universal title against Cesaro. Cesaro was interrupted by Seth Rollins right from the start. I like how one of the on-screen facts on the sidebar when Rollins walks out is that he is engaged to Becky Lynch. So for all the championships and the Money in the Bank and all of his accomplishments and his achievements in his career, apparently one of the three crowning achievements of his career is the fact that he put a ring on Becky Lynch's finger. Jey Uso came out, which, by the way, I actually agree with. Jey Uso came out ranting on Cesaro. Rollins floated the idea of the two of them taking out Cesaro together. Daniel Bryan came out, and you know what that led to. A tag team match, playa, and a very good one. That made me want to see a singles match between Bryan and Rollins, which we may never get now. Bryan got the win, though. I thought that was a bit strange until we got to the end of the show, and then it made a little more sense why they had him go over instead of Cesaro. Again, they called out Roman Reigns, who did come out earlier, but he didn't come back out here, and Bryan was acting as an advocate for Cesaro. So, art imitating life behind the scenes. They made a big deal about Reginald being back with Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler for Nia's match against Tamina. I found a piece of lint hanging from my shirt or one of those loose threads. I had to go cut it off and just long enough for the match to be over. So, damn it, I missed the entire thing. You hate to see it. Kevin Owens, he challenged Apollo Crews for the Intercontinental title on this show. There was tension backstage before the match when Big E interrupted KO's promo. Owens and Crews were having a, A pretty strong match until the lame distraction finish. Sami Zayn walked out in the middle of the match to provide commentary. Commander Aziz stepped up onto the apron. He distracted KO long enough for Cruz to roll him up for the win. After the match, Owens stunned Zayn. Aziz used the Samoan spike, which they are now calling the Nigerian nail, to put down KO. And Zayn did this ridiculous dance over the fallen body of Kevin Owens. In the back after his win during his victory promo, Apollo got jumped by Big E. Aziz was off in the locker room somewhere, so he wasn't there. I love that we have four men clamoring to be the Intercontinental Champion. Apollo Crews has it. Big E wants it back. So does Kevin Owens. And so does Sami Zayn. It's about time that that title gets some respect. And as we move closer to Money in the Bank in June, I think Sami Zayn has moved into my favorites column right now for the win on the men's side. I just think Sami walking around with that thing would be entertaining. The only thing is, until Roman loses the title, there would be absolutely no chance of people believing that he would successfully cash that briefcase in. I just think the television leading up to it would be entertaining. Guess who popped up on my television screen for the first time in 6 months? Why, it's Aleister Black. He's alive. And the first of a series of new vignettes aired that I told you about last week, they had recently recorded. He was sitting in a chair in a dark room surrounded by candles. He was wearing eyeglasses. He was reading from a book called The Tales of the Dark Father, which, sadly, you cannot use our Audible trial link on. I checked. He read from Chapter 1, The Dragon, and he narrated a story over some animations. It kind of reminded me of that video they did on NXT a while back for the Xia Li storyline and the Tian Sha character. And they had those animations. It was a story about a boy who did not learn to slay the dragon, but rather he learned how to become the dragon. He said he is nothing like us. We lie to our children and turn them into even bigger monsters than we are. I don't know where this is going, but I am glad to see him back. And dark. No eye patch. He can be one of the top players on the SmackDown brand, but given the status of Daniel Bryan, it sucks that we're probably not going to get to see that match. That was one I was hoping to see. Bayley is going to be the first to challenge and lose to Bianca Belair at Backlash. They announced in a tweet on social media before the show even went live that the two of them would meet at the next pay-per-view. I am all for keeping the program going with Sasha and Bianca through SummerSlam and trying to extend it out as long as possible. I don't know if they can hold off that long for the next match, but if Bianca beats Bayley at Backlash, they can do the rematch with Sasha at Money in the Bank in June. And if Sasha wins the title back, they could easily get to a third match at SummerSlam. So in a lot of ways, you know, it would not be unlike what they did years ago with John Cena and AJ Styles. They had their first ever match between Cena and AJ was at Money in the Bank. And then there was, I think, a six-man tag in July, and then they had their rematch at SummerSlam, which was fantastic. I really enjoyed the tag match with Rey and Dominic Mysterio against Otis and Chad Gable. I just thought it was a fun match. Everybody got time to shine. The Mysterios pick up the win as they continue to build to the eventual father and son tag team title win. McAfee did say at one point, he goes, Rey Mysterio has never looked better. And that's a lie, but he did look good here, and it continues to amaze me with his injury history and with those knees. Wrestling his style, now at 46 years old, that he can still move around the way that he does and do the things that he does. Remember, he's been wrestling since he was 15 years old. A very high-flying style. And to still be flying around and doing those things, you know, over 30 years later is very impressive. I might have to fly down myself. I might have to fly back down to Colombia to get some of those stem cells myself. Although with my knee history down there, I'm probably better off staying right where I am. The show ended with a big announcement for next week's show. Cesaro and Daniel Bryan were back out to call out Roman Reigns to see whether or not he would accept Cesaro's challenge. Roman did come out, but he rejected Cesaro's challenge. He said, I'm the one who makes the challenges. And he issued one, instead, to Daniel Bryan. He said he's tired of seeing his face. This Friday, Bryan gets one more shot at the Universal Championship. Bryan looked conflicted about it. Cesaro said, you got to accept. Doing his best Bret Hart to Hulk Hogan at the end of WrestleMania 9. Reigns said there was one condition. When he beats Daniel Bryan, he doesn't want to see his face ever again. You vanish. You disappear from SmackDown. And I thought to myself, oh my God, he's sending Daniel Bryan to 205 Live. I can think of few fates worse than that. If he doesn't want to see him ever again, that'd be the best place to send him. Bryan accepted the challenge, and so this Friday on SmackDown, not only do we get Big E against Apollo Crews for the Intercontinental title, but Roman Reigns will defend the Universal Championship against Daniel Bryan, and if Bryan fails to win the title, he must leave SmackDown forever. They are loading up the show because it is running opposite the NFL draft. So if you're wondering why are they putting these big title matches on TV this week, there's your answer. Bryan has been very vocal about his contract being up soon. He hasn't said exactly when, only that it's relatively soon. I believe it may be sometime in the fall. And he said that he's trying to work out a deal, however unlikely it may be, where he can still wrestle for WWE, but also be allowed to wrestle matches outside of WWE. He said he's trying to weasel his way into such a deal right now. I cannot ever imagine WWE allowing him to work matches in Mexico or Japan or Ring of Honor while under contract with them. But hey, best of luck in trying. If it's a difference between having the man walk or keeping him under contract with my company, I would work something out with him. But that's just not how WWE operates. It's not WWE policy to allow that. You know, you allow that for one. How do you not allow that for others? How come Edge can't have that kind of deal? How come Seth Rollins can't have that kind of deal? This match on Friday reeks of an Edge run-in. We have not seen Edge since WrestleMania. I'm sure that he holds Bryan responsible for ruining his dream of becoming champion. Edge costs Daniel Bryan the match on Friday, and he sends him packing. But not out of the company. He goes to Monday Night Raw. And hell, maybe he could even work some matches on NXT. Right? Finn Balor did it. If Bryan wants to, then why not? But Bobby Lashley is going to need more babyface challengers if he can get past Drew McIntyre at Backlash. And who knows, they may put the title right back on Drew. But if Lashley can come out of that pay-per-view next month with the title, they need babyfaces. They need top names. And they just don't have very many, if any. So if Bryan really is leaving in a few months, why not send him to Raw and let him work with Lashley and a few other people to add a little more star power to the show? You know, you add a much-needed babyface to the show. Let him wrestle Lashley in front of live fans at SummerSlam, and then if he can't work something out with the company, then he leaves. You know, when you listen to Daniel Bryan speak, this is a man who loves wrestling. And I think leaving WWE for a while would reinvigorate him. You know, he told BT Sport after his WrestleMania match, he was in the main event of WrestleMania this year, in the championship match. And he told BT Sport, he said he felt very detached. He said, it was really bizarre. It's taken me time to fully process what the experience was like because it wasn't like a normal thing. I felt very out of body in it. When I'm wrestling, I feel everything and I feel like I'm enjoying it. This was weird. I was out there and it felt like I was detached. It was so strange that before the match started, I got this strange feeling like, oh no, is this what it's like before you die? Am I going to die? Huh. Well, okay. I don't know why or how it happened, but it was unlike anything I have felt while wrestling. I think leaving WWE would reinvigorate him. I really do. You know, the different people that he would get to work with in different promotions, in different countries. I know he wants to be a dad and he wants to spend more time with his family, but if he had the chance to do big matches here and there against the people he thinks it would be fun to work with, I guarantee you he would do it in a heartbeat. He's talked about how he wants to do a hair match in Mexico. He's got a lot of goals on his wrestling bucket list that he will not be able to fulfill so long as he works for WWE. They will not let that happen. And then my mind begins to wander as I think back to the idea that I pitched last week of CM Punk and Samoa Joe maybe in a few months down the road coming together to work a match against each other at maybe this big independent event like a pay-per-view or an iPay-per-view they can build up, like an all-in type of thing. Now you throw in a free agent Bryan Danielson into the mix? Punk, Joe, and Bryan could very well find themselves all free agents at the same time in a matter of months if Bryan leaves. If you are a promoter, that has to be a tantalizing prospect. I would like to see Daniel Bryan as the traveling veteran before he retires. Yeah, I talked about CM Punk's comments earlier about Will Ospreay and the possibility of him working a match with Ospreay. Imagine Bryan in a big Tokyo Dome match against Will Ospreay or really any of those guys. You don't think that wouldn't appeal to him? He loves wrestling. I don't care how detached he felt at WrestleMania. The man loves professional wrestling. And sometimes you need to break away from WWE to rediscover that love. NXT this week, Kyle O'Reilly has a new look. He walked out wearing a denim jacket, sunglasses, and a fedora. Yes, he was dressed like Orange Cassidy, except Orange Cassidy doesn't rock the fedora. But Kyle O'Reilly wants you to know that that's who he is. He wrote on his Instagram, "Thank you, Internet, for informing me that nobody else on the planet Earth is allowed to wear a denim jacket ever again. My goal in wrestling has always been to be my authentic, quirky self, maintaining my artistic integrity and originality." It's fine. It's fine. But it's going to take some getting used to seeing him like that, you know, without Undisputed Era. He's coming off this big grudge feud with Adam Cole. Now he's out there looking like a hipster. It'll take some time. In his promo, he singled out Karrion Kross and the NXT Championship before being interrupted by Cameron Grimes, who wanted to take his money and invest in Kyle O'Reilly. So Kyle played along for a little bit before decking Grimes. That led to them meeting in the main event, which O'Reilly won, as he should have. If they're trying to establish him as a top-tier babyface, maybe a number one contender even, for the championship, then he needs to win. Indy Hartwell continues to pursue Dexter Lumis, but it's cost him a win over LA Knight on this past show. They had a match. She was up on the apron with her eyes closed, waiting for Lumis to kiss her when the Garganos and Austin Theory yanked her down off the apron, and that was enough of a distraction for LA Knight to pick up the win. Knight needed a win. Lumis' story continues. You know, I think the whole thing with him and Hartwell, it's harmless fun. It might give him more personality if he ends up speaking soon. Right now, he's a mute. He's a fucking mute. He doesn't say anything. You know, even The Undertaker used to say, "Rest in peace," you know, even though Paul Bearer would do most of the talking for him. You know, at some point, you gotta change things up a little bit. I don't know if this is the answer or not, but at least they're trying something with him. Beth Phoenix was interviewing Io Shirai in a sit-down pre-taped at the Performance Center. Io, in English, was talking about possibly taking a break after losing her championship to Raquel Gonzalez. They were interrupted by Frankie Monet and her dog, and Monet said it was nice to meet Io, and Monet was excited to meet Beth Phoenix as well, and I think she made a comment, "I used to watch you as a kid." And since Io was taking a break, Monet said that she wanted to fill her shoes, and she went on to say that her shoes were better anyway, and Io jumped to her feet. She cut a promo on Monet in Japanese, and Frankie said she didn't understand a word that she just said, and Io said, "I like cats," and she walked away. Damn right, Cats rule. And you don't have to walk them either. So it looks like they may be setting up something with Shirai and Monet. It looks like Io is going to be staying put on NXT, which is for the better. I mean, for all the obvious reasons, do I need to list what they are? Unless she's just sticking around long enough to put over Monet. And then she's going to leave, and then she's going to go to Raw or go to SmackDown. It's such a weird thing. Like, the idea of Io Shirai going to SmackDown and working with Sasha Banks and working with Bianca Belair, or going to Raw and working with Rhea Ripley and working with all these different people. It's something to get excited about, and yet I can't bring myself to get excited at all. I'm terrified at the prospect for her. I'm terrified at the prospect of her being called down to one of those two shows. And once Vince McMahon gets his hands on her, and, you know, she can speak English, but, you know, again, it's not her first language, and you never know how things are going to go with people like that on the main roster. It usually does not go well. Now, you could say it went well for Asuka. It doesn't mean it's going to go well for Io. And I don't want to see that happen. We had the grizzled young veterans picking up a win over Breezango, who made their entrance as members of the British Queen's Guards. I really hate the Breezango stuff. I really do. I hate it. I don't find it funny at all. I don't find it amusing at all. I just don't like it. We had the NXT debut of Sarray, the Warrior of the Sun from Japan, the latest Joshi export. Asuka has found success in NXT and the main roster. Kairi Sane did for a while. Io Shirai has an NXT. Like I said, I can't necessarily say the same for the main roster if she gets called down. But this was meant to be a showcase for Sarray. Zoe Stark, I thought, got enough offense, though, in there to come out of it looking good, too. You know, I said previously, they must think very highly of Stark. Because look at who she has been working with. Look at who she has been associated with, hanging out with, since she debuted only a couple of months ago. I thought it was a good first showing for Sarray. I didn't see anything out of the ordinary, but it's only one match. Sarray won with a suplex. She embraced Zoe when the match was over, only for Stark to be attacked in the aisle by Toni Storm. Sarray rushed to her aid and Storm backed away. I thought Kushida and Oney Lorcan had a fun match. Lorcan accepted Kushida's open challenge for the Cruiserweight title. Lorcan doesn't have much to do now with Danny Burch out with an injury. So it's good to get him on TV doing something else. Legado del Fantasma jumped Kushida after the match and MSK made the save. And so, of course, this Tuesday we're getting Kushida and MSK against all three members of Legado del Fantasma. And as I mentioned earlier, Kyle O'Reilly beat Cameron Grimes in a very good main event. O'Reilly turned Grimes inside out with a lariat, hit the axe and smash, and finished him off with a diving knee drop off the top rope. O'Reilly had a brief stare down in the back with Karrion Kross and Scarlett on his way to the ring for this match, so they are definitely teasing, more than teasing, that is the next direction. The challenge is that we have already seen Kyle O'Reilly challenge twice for the NXT Championship against Finn Balor. And both times he lost. So for him to challenge for the title for a third time in just the span of a few months and lose again, this time to Karrion Kross, I don't see how that helps him. If you're trying to build up O'Reilly as a real contender in the singles division, one of your top male babyfaces, I don't know that thrusting him into another championship match so soon and then having him lose again. I mean, does anybody expect him to win the title from Kross? Kross just got it back. If he's going to win, that's a different story, but I would be very surprised to see that happen. I don't know what good that does him. Maybe it would be better for them to build him up for Johnny Gargano in the North American title instead.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, a week where 32 years ago on April 21st, 1989... Nintendo released its handheld console in Japan called Game Boy. It hit the US in July of that year. I still have mine with my WWF Steel Cage Challenge game. 31 years ago this week, on April 23rd, 1990, at a WWF television taping in Austin, Texas, in a match that aired on the May 19th episode of Superstars, Mr. Perfect defeated Tito Santana in the finals of the tournament to crown a new Intercontinental Champion after the Ultimate Warrior was forced to vacate the title following his win over Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 6. Two very odd things about this. First, there was a tournament semifinal match that was taped the next night between Rowdy Roddy Piper and Rick Martel, where both men fought to a double disqualification. That made the other semifinal between Perfect and Santana the final match. So by the time this semifinal match went to the ring, the tournament was already over, and a new champion had already been crowned. But pre-internet, you could get away with that stuff, so long as it aired in the correct order on television. And second, when Perfect won the title, he announced Bobby the Brain Heenan as his new manager, his Perfect manager, and the pair celebrated with a WWF Tag Team title belt. To this day, I have no idea why the Intercontinental belt wasn't there. If it was misplaced, or they just didn't bring it to the taping. I have no idea. 29 years ago this week, on April 25th, 1992, the very first ECW champion was crowned. Eastern Championship Wrestling, that is, which was a member of the National Wrestling Alliance. They held two separate battle royals, one of which was won by Salvatore Bellomo, the other by Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Snuka then defeated Bellomo to become the inaugural ECW champion. WWE does not acknowledge any of the ECW title reigns before Shane Douglas. That was the whole Dennis Coraluzzo fiasco and what led to Eastern Championship Wrestling being rechristened as Extreme Championship Wrestling. But Snuka was technically the first ECW champion. If anybody knows a thing or two about taking things to the extreme, it would be Jimmy Snuka. 27 years ago this week at a WCW Saturday night taping at Center Stage in Atlanta for an episode to air on May 14th. A rare world title change on the show when Ric Flair pinned Ricky Steamboat in their final ever match against one another 38 minutes in after Steamboat attempted a leapfrog and Flair crashed headfirst into his groin. He covered Steamboat to win the world title number 12. For the Nature Boy, this after the title was held up after their Spring Stampede match. A very good match with a very anticlimactic finish. 25 years ago this week, on April 20th, 1996, it's 4:20, and it is ECW Hostile City Showdown from the ECW Arena in Philadelphia for one of the most memorable angles in ECW history. Here was the setup. To the main angle, Raven had brought in a new valet months earlier who started managing him named Kimona. And Kimona was a go-go dancer that he was apparently friendly with. I believe she is Korean. And he talked her into getting involved in pro wrestling. Kimona Wanalea was the name that she went by, which if you say that really fast, sounds a little bit like, come on, I Wanalea. Hence the name. She was Raven's replacement for Beulah McGillicuddy, who used to be with Raven and had announced that she was pregnant with Tommy Dreamer's child. After she announced that, Raven dropped her and brought in Kimona. Fast forward to April. Raven slapped her. He slapped Kimona. And she vowed revenge on him, which brings us to this show. Shane Douglas comes out with Kimona by his side. And he calls out Tommy Dreamer before informing him that Beulah was cheating on him while she was also cheating on Raven. And he revealed that Beulah was never really pregnant. And when Dreamer inquired as to who the man was that she was cheating on him with, Douglas said, "It's not a he." At which point Kimona grabbed the microphone out of his hand and revealed that it was her. And Beulah then came down to the ring and she and Kimona made out until Dreamer grabbed them both by the hair. And Douglas asked Dreamer, "What do you have to say?" And Tommy replied, "I'll take them both. I'm hardcore." before kissing Komoda, and then he kissed Beulah, and then he brought them both together. He brought them both in for a three-way kiss before leaving with both women. I do believe that this was the first lesbian moment on a pro wrestling show. I mean, I know that ECW innovated the three-way dance, but this moment gives it a whole new meaning. 23 years ago this week, on April 19th, 1998, WCW hosted its Spring Stampede pay-per-view, which featured Bill Goldberg beating Perry Saturn to earn a United States Championship match on Nitro the following night. Raven winning the U.S. title from Diamond Dallas Page in a match contested under Raven's rules. Hollywood Hogan and Kevin Nash beat Rowdy Roddy Piper and the Giant in a baseball bat on a pole match, bro. This was pre-Russo. Baseball bat on a pole. And Randy Savage beat Sting to become the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. Backstage, Eric Bischoff was telling people that he was going to tie up Ric Flair in court until the end of his contract in 2001 to prevent him from going to WWE. This after WCW filed a $2 million lawsuit against Flair a few days earlier, claiming breach of contract by no-showing some dates he was scheduled for, which, and I quote, played havoc with the script of the wildly popular productions. This is from the lawsuit. It also claimed that Flair no-showing a planned recreation of the Four Horsemen with Flair as the leader, quote, disrupted WCW's ability to introduce its planned storyline, causing significant loss of time, money, and effort by WCW. And per the April 20th, 1998 issue of the Wrestling Observer, the New Horsemen group was to have consisted of Flair as the leader, Lex Luger, Bill Goldberg, which I don't think that would have worked, and one other individual whose name was not finalized, plus Arn Anderson would have been the manager of the group. The situation with Flair in WCW was pretty much this. He had worked some dates for the company, and then he had plans to fly home, and he was going to take his then 9-year-old son, Reed, to the Freestyle Wrestling Nationals for his age group, which were being held at the Pontiac Silverdome. And Reed won the championship. So he wanted to go watch his son wrestle. And it's a good thing he did, because Reed was victorious. Flair claimed that he had asked for the time off months earlier, but it wasn't until that week that he got word that he was going to be needed at TV. And when he didn't show, Bischoff went nuclear. He met with the wrestlers backstage. This might have been the Monday prior. Called Flair a bullshit artist, said Flair was done with the company, he was going to sue him into bankruptcy and make an example out of him. This is where all the anger comes from. When Flair ultimately did return in September on Nitro and he went off on Bischoff, you know, they kind of worked it into the storyline. But that was very real. The heat and the anger and the resentment was very real. It carried over into WWE. You know, Flair beat Bischoff to the company by a few months, but when Bischoff came in, if you remember, there was an incident behind the scenes in WWE in 2002, I guess it would have been, where Flair attacked him and they had to be separated. Now I think they're cool, but Flair harbored a lot of very real animosity for many years towards Eric Bischoff. They might have kind of turned it into a little bit of a storyline, but it wasn't no storyline. He did not like this man at all. And apparently the feeling was mutual from Bischoff's end. The next night, on Nitro, Goldberg beat Raven to win the U.S. title. One of my all-time favorite WCW matches. The crowd was boiling hot for Big Bill. Big Bill. And when he hit Raven with that first spear, you could see the people in the crowd. They rose to their feet in unison. It's like somebody pushed a button. You got heated seats in your car. It's like they're all heated seats. And somebody just pushed a button and drove it up to 200 degrees Fahrenheit. Everybody just leaped up. They leapt up out of their seat. And if Randy Savage won the world title the night before, well, you can guess who won it back from him the very next night. Why, of course, it was Hollywood Hogan. And he won it with an assist from an unlikely supporter in Bret Hart, who turned heel and cost Savage the belt. Nitro was back on top after losing to Raw the week before, which ended their streak of wins at 83 weeks. hence the name of Bischoff's podcast. That was dating all the way back to June 17, 1996. That's how long that streak was, that winning streak for Nitro. Nitro started a new streak on this night with a win, the 5.1 rating to Raw's 4.4. They combined for a 9.5, or roughly 7 million viewers watching pro wrestling on a Monday night. The Hogan Savage main event drew what was then the all-time record rating for cable TV, 6.5. which beat out the 6.0 that Raw did 1 week earlier for their tease of a championship match between Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, which had been interrupted by Dude Love. I remember watching that live and how pissed off I was at Dude Love for fucking up the Austin-McMahon match. A few days later, on April 22nd, 1998, on a live episode of WCW Thunder, during a tag team match pitting Lex Luger and Rick Steiner against Buff Bagwell and Scott Norton, Bagwell suffered a severe neck injury and was nearly paralyzed when taking a top rope bulldog from Rick Steiner. Steiner hit the mat before Buff did, and Bagwell's head went right into Steiner's body on the way down. It looked far worse on the replay, and they replayed it a whole bunch of times. Scott Steiner got into the ring with a chair. He hit his brother across the back with it. Then he tried to place Bagwell on top of Rick for the pin. But you could tell something was very wrong. The referee counted the fall anyway, and when Norton tried dragging Bagwell out of the ring and he wasn't moving, that's when he realized something was wrong. It took 30 minutes to get him out of the ring. He could move his arms, could have feeling in his upper body, but he had no feeling in his legs. They immobilized his neck. They had no stretcher. They had no stretcher. They had no backboard to place him on. There was no ambulance. Like today, you know, there's an ambulance present at every show. They had to wait for one to arrive. Tony Schiavone, Bobby Heenan, and Mike Tenay, they were left to kill time while they tended to Bagwell, who suffered 4 crushed vertebrae in his neck and underwent surgery a few days later to fuse his C3 and C4 and his C5 and C6. Vertebrae together. It was not without complications. He almost lapsed into a coma, but they stabilized him. Doctors told him that he came within 3 centimeters of being paralyzed for life, like the actor Christopher Reeve. And after returning home from surgery, he ended up back in intensive care. His blood pressure spiked. He was having trouble breathing. So like I said, you know, Bagwell had a lot of complications. A lot of potentially life and death situations he had to go through after that injury. He was also having internal bleeding. He almost went into cardiac arrest. It was a mess. But a few months later, when they wheeled Bagwell out for a promo on Nitro at the Georgia Dome, that was the big show where Bill Goldberg beat Hollywood Hogan to win the WCW title. You watched that and you came away from that show. You came away from that segment with Bagwell, that show, thinking that Bagwell could have come back and been a huge babyface in that company. The reaction he got was probably second only to Goldberg that night. But this is WCW. 2 weeks later, on the July 20th Nitro, they pissed it all away by wheeling him back out there. He told Rick Steiner that he forgave him for what he did. Scott Steiner ran out with a chair. He attacked his brother. Bagwell staggered out of his wheelchair. He grabbed the steel chair out of Scott's hands, and then he turned and he used it on Rick Steiner himself. And he ripped his neck brace off. He, you know, revealed an NWO shirt for the big swerve. You talk about wasting a perfectly good comeback story. 21 years ago this week, on April 25th, 2000, at the WCW Thunder Show in Syracuse, New York, David Arquette pinned Eric Bischoff in a tag team match to become the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. The match was Diamond Dallas Page, who was the champion at the time, tagging with Arquette to take on Jeff Jarrett and Eric Bischoff. Arquette was starring in the film Ready to Rumble, which bombed, made $12 million with a budget of double that. As if the WCW title had not already been rendered completely worthless that year with all the title changes, this right here just put it right over the top. Even before they got to Thunder on this night, allow me, if I may, to recite to you all of the times that the WCW title changed hands in the year 2000. Now, mind you, this is only up to and including the month of April. This doesn't include any of the other title changes that came later in the year. January 16th, the title is vacated. That same night, Chris Benoit wins the title. The next day, the title is vacated when Benoit leaves the company. A week later, Sid wins the title back. The next night, Sid is stripped of the title by Commissioner Kevin Nash. Three words that should never go together. That same night, Nash awards the title to himself. But then still later that same night, loses it back to Sid. April 10th, all titles are declared vacant by Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo in a storyline reset of the company. April 16th, Jeff Jarrett wins the title. April 24th, Diamond Dallas Page wins the title. The very next night, David Arquette wins the title. And then, just in the month of May, we gotta do May as well. Just in the month of May, the title goes from David Arquette to Jeff Jarrett to Ric Flair, vacated again, back to Jeff Jarrett, back to Kevin Nash the next night, back to Ric Flair, then back to Jarrett that same night. So, for anyone who thinks that WCW putting the title on David Arquette is what devalued the championship, whatever value it had, that title was already dead. It was dead, it was buried. Please. The 24/7 title that R-Truth carries around now has more value than the WCW title did in the year 2000. But that doesn't mean that it was a good decision to put the title on David Arquette. It wasn't. It was stupid. It was stupid. It was garbage. And we have not just Vince Russo to thank for it. I mean, he pushed it through ultimately, but Tony Schiavone is the one who is credited with pitching the idea to Russo in the first place. Now, whether he was being completely serious, whether he was only half being serious, doesn't matter. Tony Schiavone bears a lot of the blame here as well. Russo loved it, because of course he did. But Schiavone, on his What Happened When podcast, had this to say about the whole situation. He said, David Arquette was not going to win the championship. The booking meeting adjourned, and I was sitting to the right of Vince Russo. Vince looked at me and said, what are you thinking? I said, nothing. He goes, what are you thinking? I remember him turning to me and he said, so you want David Arquette to win the world title? I said, well, that's a thought. Did anybody think of that? He said, well, let me give that a thought. DDP was the champion and thought they were joking with him when they first pitched the idea to him. This is what he told WrestleZone back in 2015. He said, I remember them telling me because I was the world champion at the time. They weren't going to beat me for it. They wanted to put it on Arquette for the PR. I just think they wanted a boost of super PR and I started laughing. I thought they were fucking with me. And I went, so what are we really going to do? And they said, well, we're going to do this. I'm going, dude, you can't be serious. And on David Arquette's reaction, this is what DDP said. So now I got to go tell David. And when I tell him what they were going to do and what they were going to do for the finish, he started laughing and going, fuck you. And I go, dude, I'm serious. And he realized I was serious and he goes, dude, no, we can't do that. He was a fan through the whole thing. He was that guy going, no, they can't. So I go, here's your choices. Either you don't do it and we're done because we're not going to do the angle because that's the finish. Or you do it and guess what? You're the world champion. You are getting the fantasy that every single fan would kill to be in your spot. Arquette told Alex Marvez in a separate interview, obviously, I don't deserve it. These guys are so skilled and it takes so much athleticism and gymnastics and strength, not to mention all the acting stuff that goes into it. It's really hard. So, you know, Arquette, and that's always been the story. Arquette was very resistant to wanting to do it because he was a fan. He was a genuine pro wrestling fan. So his reaction was probably the same as it would have been my reaction, your reaction, when you hear this for the first time. You're thinking, God, that's the fucking dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. And so he probably felt the same way, and he knew there would be backlash. He knew it was a ridiculous idea. Now, to his credit, he's a class dude. He donated his earnings for all of the WCW appearances, all the WCW stuff he did, to the families of Owen Hart, Brian Pillman, and Darren Drozdov. So all of his earnings, all the money they paid him went, you know, he split it between the families. Russo still contends that it was a good idea because it got them coverage in USA Today. So therefore, it was a great idea. You had TV shows like Entertainment Tonight, Extra, Access Hollywood. They all mentioned the title win as well. Probably a brief little segment. It got them buzz. That's what he said. It was a great idea because it got WCW buzz. It did indeed. It did indeed. They were the laughingstock of pro wrestling. You know what all that buzz got them? Because it certainly didn't help the movie any if the idea was, well, maybe it'll boost ticket sales and interest in the movie Ready to Rumble. It certainly didn't do that. Didn't help the box office for the next pay-per-view. Ticket sales for Slamboree grinded to a halt. And the television ratings that Russo lived and died by, the most important thing to Vince Russo, the television ratings, Thunder that night, the night of the match, was down from the previous episode, and the main event did the lowest rating of any segment on the entire show. Nitro the following Monday, because you might say, well, you know, he didn't win the title until the end of the show, you got to go by the next rating. Okay, Nitro the following Monday was down 600,000 viewers from the week before. So by every metric that actually matters, every business metric, it was a fucking failure. 19 years ago this week, on April 21st, 2002, the final WWF pay-per-view to be held before the changeover to WWE was Backlash. And back then, they weren't calling it WrestleMania Backlash. It was implied that it was Backlash from WrestleMania. You didn't have to beat people over the head with it. From the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, this was their first pay-per-view there, not TV taping, but their first pay-per-view since Owen Hart fell to his death in that building. It was Brock Lesnar's first pay-per-view match, a win over Jeff Hardy. Kurt Angle beat Edge in an excellent match. They would have an even better match a month later at Judgment Day when Kurt lost his hair. Eddie Guerrero beat Rob Van Dam to win the Intercontinental title. Undertaker beat Stone Cold Steve Austin to become the number one contender for the WWF title. And in the main event, just a month after becoming the undisputed champion at WrestleMania 18, the big climax of his return from a torn quad after 8 months on the shelf, Triple H's reign came to an abrupt halt as he lost the championship to Hulk Hogan, who had last held that title in 1993. Hogan was probably always going to have one last run with the belt after the inevitable babyface turn when he came back, but that babyface turn happened only a month after returning as a heel, as part of the NWO, because of all the reactions that he was getting. They decided you got to strike while the iron is hot, and they turned him immediately. They did not plan to take the title from Triple H so quickly. In fact, the morning of the show, the plan was for Triple H to win the match. But Vince McMahon changed his mind late to putting the title on Hogan. Didn't do much to increase business, and a month later he dropped the belt to The Undertaker in a bad match that gave us one of the worst chokeslam spots of all time. But it did also give us one of the best bits of unintentional comedy in Raw history when Hogan tried to ride a motorcycle up the ramp towards Undertaker, but the bike stalled, and Hogan had to climb off and chase Taker on foot. And then, don't forget, let us not forget Undertaker tying Hogan to the back of his bike and dragging him through the hallway in the back. You know, the more I think about, and I've always said this, but when I really stop and think about Hogan's run in 2002... like the babyface run that he had for himself, Hogan was more giving than he normally would be that year when he came back. Because I think he knew, you know, he has to try to ingratiate himself and don't rock the boat and show that he's a team player. Because he lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. He won the title, but then he lost it a month later to The Undertaker. He tapped out to Kurt Angle, which was huge. Not even that he lost to Kurt and put him over, but how he put him over. Hogan was a babyface. Kurt was the heel and Hogan was the babyface, and Hogan tapped out. How many times in the history of Hulk Hogan's career has he tapped out as a babyface? I mean, he's done it a few times as a heel, you know, staying in WCW. But as a babyface, I mean, that's a... Honestly, I can't remember a single time up to that point. Up to that point, in June of 2002, I cannot remember a single instance of Hulk Hogan in any promotion as a babyface, as a top babyface. I mean, back then, there was no tapping out. I mean, you submitted. I can't remember an instance of that happening. So that was huge, what he did for Kurt in that match. And then don't forget, he lost to Brock Lesnar a couple months later on television, not even on pay-per-view, but on television in a bear hug. But I guess he had enough after that because he reportedly wanted to come back that fall and win the title from Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series. And they rightfully told him to piss off. That would have been a terrible idea. Hey, the crowd in MSG that night, maybe they would have eaten it up, but that would have been a fucking terrible idea. 14 years ago this week, on April 23rd, 2007, Shawn Michaels and John Cena had one of the greatest matches in Raw history. From Earl's Court in London, England, this was weeks after their main event at WrestleMania 23. They went nearly an hour, just shy of 56 minutes, in a non-title rematch that Michaels won with a super kick. Michaels told NBC Sports, "That turned out at the very end of our European tour that year. We had already been on the road there for over a week. I found out what we were doing when I got to the building and was like, oh my goodness." I like this match more than I did their WrestleMania match. And it actually increased the rating for the second hour of the show, and it held the audience, unlike the Kurt Angle-Brock Lesnar Iron Man match from SmackDown in 2003. And I know why. I mean, it's clear as day why this worked better. And I think as a general rule, when you do this sort of thing, it works better than, you know, announcing it as an Iron Man match, because it wasn't. It was not announced in advance as an Iron Man match. They didn't tell you, hey, this match is going to go 60 minutes. This match is going to go 56 minutes. You didn't know when it was going to end. As far as anybody knew, it was just a regular, straight-up one-on-one match. They even announced an Edge versus Randy Orton match for this show that got bumped because the main event went so long. I like that. It's a nice little touch. Now, I don't know where I would rank this one in John Cena's career, because he had some fantastic matches with a whole bunch of different people. CM Punk, AJ Styles. You know, Cena's resume of big matches is very impressive. History is going to be far kinder to John Cena's body of work than people were at the time that he was active. And this match is going to be on a lot of those lists. 13 years ago this week, on April 21st, 2008, Monday Night Raw was 3 hours, back when that was a special thing, featuring the return of the King of the Ring tournament for the first time since 2006. They needed a gimmick to occupy 3 hours, and so they brought back the King of the Ring, and they proceeded to crap all over it. They pulled their pants down, and they took a giant heaping dump on this King of the Ring tournament. First round matches included such classics as the Great Khali against Fit Finlay and William Regal against Hornswoggle. And we did get a CM Punk Chris Jericho semifinal match, but I remember watching these matches live. I remember watching them. They got no time at all. I was watching this actually from my hotel room in Boca Raton, Florida, and the matches were just not good. They were short, nothing matches. The finals had Punk against Regal, which you would think had the potential to be something special, but how could it? How could it be when you only give those guys 4 minutes? That's how long the finals were. 4 minutes. Punk tapped out to the Regal stretch to give Regal the win and the crown. Why give some of these matches extra time when you could take that time and do a match pitting a Hillary Clinton impersonator against a Barack Obama impersonator? Oh, yes. That was on this show. Lillian Garcia introduced Hillary as a devoted Hulkamaniac. She asked the crowd, what you gonna do when the superdelegates run wild on you? And then she posed. This was a presidential election year, in case you couldn't tell. Obama, he was pretending to be The Rock Obama. Remember that from SNL? He hit Hillary with a rock bottom and a people's elbow, but Bill Clinton tripped him. That brought out Umaga to save us from this misery. He gave Obama the Samoan spike, Hillary a Samoan drop. To end the segment, I guess we know which party he did not vote for that year. 11 years ago this week, on April 19, 2010, WWE presented an episode of Monday Night SmackDown from the Izod Center in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Why Monday Night SmackDown? Because the Raw crew was still stranded overseas due to a volcanic eruption days earlier that shut down air travel all throughout much of Europe. The Raw and SmackDown rosters were in Europe for the WrestleMania Revenge Tour, and were already around 15 shows deep into the tour when the... Oh boy, I'm going to attempt to pronounce this right, the name of this volcano. I'm sure I'm going to butcher it. But let's give it a shot. The Eyjafjallajökull. Eyjafjallajökull volcano erupted in Iceland. Seriously, you need to see the spelling of this thing. It is ridiculous. It sent volcanic ash up into the clouds, making it very dangerous to fly. This was the update from WWE.com at the time. The Icelandic volcano has wreaked havoc on the European travel scene, including the itineraries of WWE's Raw and SmackDown superstars and divas traveling on the final legs of their two-week post-WrestleMania tour. The Mid-Atlantic volcano began to erupt violently on Wednesday, sending a gigantic plume of ash into the atmosphere that contained tiny bits of rock and glass, elements which could choke an airplane's jet engines. With airspace being closed to travel due to safety concerns all over Europe, travel agents got quite a workout as the superstars and divas rerouted their journey to their next live event via any means necessary, whether by train, ferry, or coach bus. The Raw crew was in France on April 15th, and instead of flying to Belfast for the next two shows, according to The Miz, who was on that tour, they had to take a bus, a ferry, and another bus about 7 hours, followed by another ferry ride, and finally another 3 hours on a bus to get to Belfast. Then they ended up being stranded there and were not allowed to fly home until the 21st. To do so, they had to take a ferry from Northern Ireland to Scotland, and they flew home from there. The reason the SmackDown roster was able to fill in on Raw is because they went home early. They were driven from Zurich all the way to Madrid on a bus that was close to breaking down, and then flew home so that they could get to New Jersey for Raw. By the time they landed in Newark, New Jersey, they had spent 47 straight hours in transit. And then they went straight to Raw. The only Raw star to make the show was the one star who did not go on the tour from hell, and that was Triple H, who spent the opening segment of the show humoring the crowd with a promo that was not without controversy. Justin Roberts was among the people stranded overseas, and so WWE made a phone call to Lillian Garcia to come back, fill in for one night to handle the ring announcing duties. For those who don't know, there was a joke many years ago, internally, that went around between Vince McMahon, Triple H, Kevin Dunn, and JBL, because they thought Lillian Garcia had a horse-shaped face. And it had gotten around, and eventually, as it did here, it got to TV with just little digs, little mentions here and there. Michael Cole made a similar crack about her the following year on commentary. On this night, Triple H was confronted by CM Punk and the Straight Edge Society, and Triple H started talking about freedom. He said, I don't believe in what you believe in. I believe in freedom. This is the United States of America. We are free to do what we want to do. Everybody is free. He then walked over to Lillian and said, even Lillian Garcia, if Lillian wants to come back here for one night to WWE just to horse around, she can do it. Mick Foley, who was working for TNA at the time, took issue with the remark. He took to his MySpace page. Yes, Mick Foley had a MySpace page. He had a blog. And he took to his blog to defend Lillian by saying, why does someone like Triple H, one of the most talented, well-paid guys in the business, do something so shallow and mean? Why would a multimillionaire with millions of fans around the world feel the need, several times over the years, to say something that is only meant to hurt? I don't get it. I don't get why it's done. I don't get why it's condoned. I don't get what possible satisfaction anyone involved gets from demeaning someone like Lillian Garcia. I just don't get it. Lillian responded to Mick on Twitter, Mick Foley, this tweet's for you. I really appreciate your kind words and the compassion you showed in your blog. Your care for my feelings proves what a loving, caring, and wonderful human being you are. This is why I truly miss working with you. You are one of a kind. Thank you. Love you. Triple H did not respond to either of their messages, and the Raw crew finally made it back stateside 4 days later. And 5 years ago this week, on April 21st, 2016, at an NXT live event in Lowell, Massachusetts, Samoa Joe beat Finn Balor to win his first NXT championship, ending Balor's record-setting 292-day reign as champion with a muscle buster. A rare world title change on a house show, and a rare world title for Samoa Joe in WWE. He would win the title a second time, and sadly, that would be his last world title in WWE. I believe I remember reading that Joe was originally supposed to win the title at TakeOver in Dallas a few weeks earlier. That was the match against Balor, where Joe got busted open early, and they kept stopping the match to have the medical personnel check his cut and clean the blood. I was sitting third row ringside for that, and Joe looked like he wanted to murder the medical crew every time they paused the match to go check on him. It's a hell of a match, though. And that is this week in wrestling history. Let's take some of your questions. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I got an email from a listener. I will not use his name, but per his request, we'll call him Anonymous18. He says, I heard your opinion on the WrestleMania main event of Sasha Banks against Bianca Belair. You enjoyed it, even though the build was worth shit. I didn't watch the main event. The build-up was not only bad, but cringe for me. I enjoyed when Becky main evented. What a story. First time women main evented and Ronda was on the show too. I'm just going to ask you this. Can you imagine having friends over for WrestleMania? They're casual fans, some from way back. When it's main event time, the friend asks, is it Brock? Is it Undertaker? Is it John Cena? No. It's Sasha Banks against Bianca Belair. What would the room be like? The only reason WWE went with this main event was the agenda. Also heard you saying, Sasha should main event multiple WrestleManias. Come on, man. Listening to you since 2009, let's be real. If there's only one night, she will never get that spot. Banks is an attraction, not a main event draw. My question is, after that room watched Banks against Belair, can those fans be drawn back? Or would they be pushed away? Take care, Solomonster. You're one of my inspirations. So much to unpack here in this question. First of all, thank you for listening since 09. One of the longtime diehards. I like hearing that. I personally, you want my opinion on things, since it was my opinion that I enjoyed the match, I don't give a fuck about the casual fan. I'm not a casual fan. I'm a professional wrestling fan. Through the good and the bad, I have stuck with this shit for many years. I know what I like, and I know what I don't like. And I don't give a fuck what the casual observer who will only watch wrestling twice a year thinks about Sasha Banks against Bianca Belair. Now, that's different than, you know, what the company thinks. The company should care about what those fans think. But you asked me for my opinion. So I'm giving you my opinion. I personally don't care. If I'm going to have people, which I wouldn't anyway, if I'm going to have people over to watch the WrestleMania main event, instead I'm off because I got to take notes. I'm not having a party. I got to go live when the event is over. There ain't going to be no gatherings at the Castle of Solomonster. But if I did, you know, you bring up the idea, is it John Cena? Is it Brock Lesnar? Is it Undertaker? See, that's part of the problem. You've just highlighted a perfect problem. They cannot continue to be reliant on the John Cenas and the Triple H's and the Undertakers and the Goldbergs of the world. While they may have big names, and those people that were watching in 2002 or 1998, they may know who those names are. And they may appeal to them. That's the old guard. They can be on the show and an attraction. You'll have Goldberg doing matches here and there. You can have those people on the show, no problem. You don't want to have those people in your main events. Now, if John Cena were to come back one day and they wanted to do the big story, can he get title number 17? That's different because there's a story there that you can tell. But just to put big names in the main events for the sake of putting big names in the main events because you don't have faith in your current roster, you're never ever going to build for the future, whether it's men, whether it's women. We're going to be sitting here in 20 years having the same fucking conversation. Oh, I used to watch wrestling in 2000, 38 years ago. Where's The Undertaker? Well, he's fucking dead, okay? Don't worry about The Undertaker. Oh, I hope he's not dead, but I'm just saying. Don't worry about the... Well, he's the dead man, so I'm not wrong. Don't worry about The Undertaker. Don't worry about John Cena. Don't worry about Triple H. You got to get new blood in there. And I don't care whether it's male or female. It could be both. At some point, you've got to move on from that mindset. You've got to move on from that attitude. And you cannot just worry about what those fans think, because guess what? Those fans, they're not paying for Peacock. They're not buying tickets to the show. You said it yourself. Oh, wrestling's on. I think I'll just come over and I'll watch. Do you think that if Brock Lesnar is in the main event of WrestleMania that year, that casual fan that you just talked about is suddenly going to start watching WWE every week? That person will not give a shit. They'll watch WrestleMania that night, and they won't watch again for another year. Now, I'm not saying the company shouldn't be doing things to appeal to those people, but they don't have to be in main events. How is anybody going to look at a Sasha Banks or a Roman Reigns or someone like that or a Big E? How are they ever supposed to look at them as main eventers if you don't put them in your fucking main event? If you don't build them up enough to be in those main events, nobody will look at them as a main eventer. Now, I enjoy watching Sasha Banks. I'm not going to apologize for it. I made the comment. I didn't say that I want her in every WrestleMania main event. What I said, don't twist what I said. What I said was, this will not be her final WrestleMania main event. She will have more in the future. And she will. And probably Charlotte will as well. Becky, I don't know. I don't know what her status is. Rhonda? Rhonda's pregnant. Rhonda's having a kid. She may never come back. But that's what I said. This should be the first of many in the future WrestleMania main event matches for Sasha Banks, and maybe even for Bianca, because I like Bianca as well. You make one valid point that I agree with. If WrestleMania goes back to being one night next year, Sasha Banks ain't going to be in the WrestleMania main event. You're right. It's going to be Roman Reigns or whoever you know, the top champion is, whether it's WWE title or Universal title. If it's Roman as the champion, then it's going to be Roman Reigns, because Roman Reigns is the biggest star in the company. So it should be him defending his title in the main event of WrestleMania. Now, they can take a big women's match and they can brand it as a co-main. You could do that. And I'm not opposed to, if there's a strong enough women's match and women's story going into WrestleMania, I wouldn't object if they wanted to make that match the main event. But you're right, they're not going to. But, you know, when you say, would these fans be drawn back if they saw Sasha and Bianca in the main event? Well, then, you know what? School them, educate them. Bring them up to speed on show them some Sasha Banks matches. Show them the match with Bayley in Brooklyn. Anybody who likes pro wrestling, I don't see how you cannot watch that match and not think, hey, that was pretty good. You know, she's put together a fairly impressive resume of matches. She is one of the biggest names in the company. I didn't say the biggest. I said one of the biggest. And when you have two nights of WrestleMania, there is nothing wrong if you have a match strong enough in making that one of your main events. You're right, the build-up was shit. But guess what? You didn't watch the match because you didn't like the build. I acknowledged in the lead-up to WrestleMania, the build sucked. But I was still hopeful and looking forward to the match itself, because that was a match that I had earmarked as being the SmackDown Women's title match back in October or November. Probably November. So I was looking forward to the match. I never intended to not watch the match. I said the match was great in spite of the booking. And I would tell you to go back and watch the match because it was great. Now, if you don't want to do that, then hey, that's up to you. But, you know, clearly you're not a fan of these women and their work, and that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. But I would say before you comment on the whole match and why it didn't belong in the main event, watch the match. I thought those women lived up to expectations. I thought it was a fine main event. And I thought that the men knocked it out of the park the next night on night two. Two fine main events of WrestleMania this year. I have nothing bad to say about the main events of WrestleMania this year. And the fact that the women got the first one did not bring it down, in my view, at all, because the match I thought was great. That kind of stuff doesn't bother me. If you have old school fans who can't accept, well, the women in the main event, what a joke. Yeah, well, what do you expect? If you're talking about fans from 20 years ago, look at how the women were booked back then. They didn't start to take women's wrestling seriously in this company until 2015, 2016. That's only about 5 or 6 years. I wouldn't expect fans from 15, 20 years ago to care. Why should they? All they remember were fucking bikini contests, and they had women on the roster who, in some cases, were fucking horrendous. Women's wrestling was not a priority back then. Women's wrestling, in many cases, wasn't even that great in that company back then. What was it, the fact that the women were terrible wrestlers? Was it the fact that they were only giving them 90 seconds per match? I'm sure that had something to do with it. Their frame of reference, I don't blame them for feeling that way about the women, because look at the era of women's wrestling that they came from in WWE. This is all foreign to them now. But you're at a point now where when it comes to the casual at best or the lapsed fans who only want to see big names, those big names aren't going to be around forever. And a lot of them are gone. Undertaker is done, or so he says. Triple H, you know, he'll have some matches, but even Triple H, he wasn't even on the card this year. He's nearing the end of his rope too. These guys aren't going to be around forever. You have to start building for the future. And paying less attention to the people who are only interested in the big names in main events. You can have big names on the show. They don't have to be in your main events. You've got to build for the future. And that includes the men and the women. It can't just be one or the other. So it will not be the last time you see the women in the main event, especially if they continue to do two-night WrestleManias. You'll probably see a lot less of it if there's only one night. But look, it happened once, right? WrestleMania 35 was only one night. We had women in the main event, and never say never. But when you say that the only reason they were in the main event was the agenda, I mean, I know what you're saying. And believe me, WWE, they were more than happy to go ahead and announce that, you know, we've got women in our main event, and it's the first time in WrestleMania history that we had two black women in the main event, and that was a huge deal. I don't want to say that's the only reason they did it, but I can't speak to their motives. I, you know, knowing how this company operates, yeah, that probably had a lot to do with why they put them in the main event. Doesn't make them any less deserving, though, of being in that spot. To say otherwise, I think, is a slap in their face, and that's disrespectful to them, and that's bullshit. So I wouldn't go that far. But my opinion, I don't give a fuck about the casual fan. They're not the ones sitting in the trenches like you and me. Or at least me. You didn't even watch the match. I sit through this shit every week. To get to the good stuff. You wade through the bad stuff to get to the good stuff. I don't care about the guy who will only watch wrestling once a year because he wants to see Bill Goldberg. Fuck him. They're of no concern to me. So that would be my response to you. Hopefully you don't fall into that category. But that would be my answer to you. Isaac from Campbellton, New Brunswick. With this month marking 20 years since ECW officially closed its doors, What do you think is the promotion's lasting legacy on the pro wrestling industry? ECW's legacy is huge. It is still felt to this day whenever you see an Extreme Rules match on WWE pay-per-view or a hardcore style match on AEW television, which I feel like is every week. I mean, yeah, you had FMW in Japan, and there's some influence from there, but the influence of ECW cannot be denied. It's felt every single week. You know, the Attitude Era. I would argue there would have been no Attitude Era were it not for the influence of ECW. None! There would not have been an Attitude Era were it not for ECW. But it was that appeal to that very niche audience that really doomed them, because it prevented them. It stopped them from growing in the way that Paul Heyman probably wanted them to grow. You know, the things they were doing. It's a lot of crazy shit that happened in ECW. A lot of stuff that they got away with because in a lot of ways they were under the radar. They were very underground and they could get away with that shit. And I don't just mean using real music that they were absolutely not allowed to use. But how important was that? How important was the element of music in the original ECW? If you go back and watch the old ECW shows on the network or Peacock, when and if they ever get uploaded, you know, you don't get the music, and it really does kind of kill the vibe of a lot of the shows. But they were doing a lot of stuff, you know, with the matches and everything and the hardcore stuff, despite whatever great wrestling there may have been, that it stopped them from growing in a major way. Look, they did manage to eventually get on TNN, but it was never going to allow them to get to a mainstream level. And it would not have worked anyway, because if ECW went mainstream, I don't think their core loyal base of fans would have wanted that. It would have betrayed everything about what ECW was built on. The whole counterculture narrative, their renegade image. But the trade-off in not doing that is that it really put a cap on how much they could grow. One of the positives of ECW is that Paul Heyman gave a platform to a whole bunch of different people who may not have otherwise been given a platform. You know, the luchadors like Rey Mysterio and Juventud Guerrera, Japanese stars. Great wrestlers like Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero and Chris Jericho. These are all people who eventually made their way over to WCW, and Eric Bischoff, and I give Bischoff credit for the cruiserweight division, and that was a huge element, I think, that made Nitro so successful back then, was the mix of the high-flying younger guys, the international stars, coupled with all the main eventers in the NWO, and Sting, and Luger, and all those guys. But that probably doesn't happen, were it not for what Heyman was doing at the time with ECW. You know, they gave a platform to Steve Austin when he was hurt and he couldn't even work to come out of his shell personality-wise. He was all pissed off at the world after being fired by WCW and Eric Bischoff. And they just talked about this in the Steve Austin A&E documentary, which I watched the other day and I enjoyed it. There was no new ground covered. I did watch it. I did enjoy it. And they covered that part of it. They covered his firing from WCW and Paul Heyman picking up the phone and saying, "Hey, kid, why don't you come on down?" The number of men who made a name for themselves in ECW, even if they were just passing through, who got snatched up by Vince McMahon or Eric Bischoff and went on to become some of the biggest names in the business, it's a pretty decent-sized list. So I think the impact and the legacy of ECW is gigantic. And it's felt through all of those big names as well, who at least had this brief career for themselves, a very memorable run in ECW, and eventually led to them being who they are today. Maybe that doesn't happen if Paul Heyman doesn't give them a platform when he did. Dick from Spring Hill, Florida. Before you poo-poo all over this, please hear me out. WrestleMania 15's main event in Philadelphia was Stone Cold Steve Austin against The Rock for the WWF title. Based on the fact that the Austin versus McMahon feud was the hottest angle in wrestling history, especially in 99, can an argument be made that says Austin versus McMahon should have been the main event instead of doing it at the pay-per-view the month before? I believe this for three main reasons, other than it being the hottest angle in wrestling. But number one, Vince McMahon had never been in a match before, so you have the first time ever effect. Number two, Austin and Rock was a match the fans had already seen a number of times in 97. And number three, it would have done a bigger buy rate because with Austin facing McMahon in the main event, it would leave The Rock to face Mankind instead of whatever match Mick had with Big Show. Do you agree? I don't. And actually, I think that number three point is completely invalid. I don't see how a bigger buy rate... The Rock being in an undercard match against Mankind... You just got done telling me that Austin and Rock had a whole bunch of matches in 97. By the time Rock and Mankind would have gotten to the WrestleMania in 99, how many matches do you think they had? From the end of 90... the end of 98, right? They had that Rock Bottom pay-per-view, I think it was. All the matches they had in January and February, it was completely played out by that point. So it's the same problem that you just got done telling me that Austin and Rock would have had. So I don't agree with point number three. You know, point number two, I guess, also. But point number one, Vince had never been in a match. Yeah, I mean, you have the first ever effect, kind of. Not really, because he was in the Royal Rumble match. So it's not like people have never seen him in a match before. Maybe not a singles match, but he was technically already in the ring. I disagree. Look, the very thing that WWE spent countless hours and countless weeks and months criticizing WCW for, Jim Ross did it all the time on the air, mocking the fact that WCW had older guys in their main events, guys in their 40s, guys pushing 50. So now, as hot as the angle is, you're going to headline WrestleMania with a guy who... how old was Vince McMahon at that point, right? Early 50s, mid-50s? It would make them look very hypocritical, I think, doing that as your WrestleMania main event. The match itself just would not have been any good. You have to have a WrestleMania main event that's at least good. Doesn't have to be the best technical match in the world. It's got a good story, then that's one part of it. But I disagree. WrestleMania was going to do a nice buy rate no matter what. If anything, you could take Austin McMahon, which you know is not going to be a great match in the ring, put him in a cage, and do it on a B-show pay-per-view to boost a buy rate for a show. Let's say the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I don't have it in front of me what that show did. I want to say it did maybe 450,000 buys or something, 500 maybe. Let's say if it did 450, that's a show that normally would do 300 or 350. Well, now you did 450. Guess what? You just boosted a buy rate for a show that you know is going to do less. WrestleMania, you have to assume, is going to do pretty well, which it did. So I don't think it needed it. And I like the idea that they took two of their hottest young stars. I mean, Austin might have been mid-30s at that point, but it, as far as Rock goes... at least one of their hot young stars in the main event. And Rock was over. It was a big match. Obviously. It ended up being a WrestleMania match three different times. They only became bigger stars. Rock certainly went on to become a pretty big name, I'd say. So no, I disagree. You could have done it, but I think it was better doing it the way that they did. You popped a buy rate for a show that needed it, not a show that didn't. And you got two big matches out of it back-to-back months instead of one. So I think they did just the right thing. Jacob from Billings, Montana. Plain and simple, why all the hate for Baron Corbin? It seems like ever since his main roster debut, he has been the subject of everyone's hatred, but less in a good heat way and more of an X-Pac heat kind of way. I've always thought he was good in the ring and all right on promos, although admittedly I think he was better as the lone wolf persona. But what is it that makes people have such disdain for his character? His character is, as a heel is fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with him as a heel. He is very unlikable, I think, naturally. It's just that there's nothing exciting or really overly interesting about the guy. And the King gimmick, King Corbin, is just fucking death. I think it'll be better for him the more they move away from that. And him not wearing the crown, and him not being, oh, I'm the king, I'm the king. When did he even, he won King of the Ring like 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. How long ago was it? It was a while. It's long past its expiration date. He would benefit from a makeover. Yeah, I mean, the Lone Wolf character wasn't terrible. The time that I enjoyed Baron Corbin the most was when he was still in NXT. And he was making comments about going back to the Indies and go back to Ring of Honor. I still remember him being at TakeOver. It might have been the show in Brooklyn against Apollo Crews. And I think he made a comment, go back to Ring of Honor. I don't think Apollo had ever been in Ring of Honor. And I just remember thinking, I just thought that was the funniest thing. So there was actually a period of time where Baron Corbin, I found him somewhat appealing. On the main roster, though, he's just fucking death. I have no interest in seeing him on my screen. Now, maybe a makeover? Not a babyface turn, but some kind of makeover for his character. Maybe that could be helpful. I can't speak to why everybody else hates him. Everybody else probably has their own reasons for not liking the guy. But he's not on my favorites list. And Toph from Georgia, what is your opinion of The Sopranos ending with Tony Soprano in the diner? I think that we, the viewers of his life, were whacked and cut off from his life, and it symbolized that life goes on. I think the ending was left open-ended for the viewer to interpret. Curious to know your thoughts. Well, obviously, the ending was left open-ended. They faded to black. I mean, that's the very definition of leaving the ending open-ended for the viewer. And by the way, I am looking forward to the prequel, the Many Saints of Newark movie that is coming out this fall. No, my interpretation is very simple, that Tony was whacked. Period, end of story. He got killed at the end. And David Chase wanted to let people interpret it the way that they wanted to, but I believe that the intent was to represent that he was killed. And the moment that things went black, that represented the moment that he got shot. And they even alluded to it in an episode earlier that last season when he was on the boat, right, with Bobby. And the guy made a comment about wondering, I wonder what it's like, you know, at the end. When you get whacked, I wonder what it's like if you hear it. Wonder if you hear anything. And they talked about how it probably just fades to black. I mean, it seemed pretty black and white to me as far as what that ending represented. You know, the guy gets up, he goes to the bathroom, that weird-looking, creepy guy, while Tony and his family are sitting there eating onion rings. And then all of a sudden, it just fades to black. So, he's dead. I mean, he's dead in real life, unfortunately. That was very sad. But the Tony Soprano character, once that episode was over, seemed pretty apparent to me that he was no longer among the living. But you can interpret it any way you want. That's what David Chase wanted. He wanted to get people talking. I remember thinking, man, what a cop-out finish that was, right? What a lame finish, like it's a match. But that's what I think happened. If you have questions for me, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Remember, please include your name and where you are from. That will always help your chances of getting your question used on the air. And if you are a YouTube channel member, go ahead and check out the post in the community section. You can leave questions for a potentially used in the upcoming members-only Q&As coming very soon to the YouTube channel. If you want to join, there are two different membership tiers. You can go to youtube.com/thesolemonster, click the join button, and a little video will pop up with me explaining everything to you. There's other little perks that come along with it. Early access to certain special features. You get special emojis and badges in the live chat. Retro audio, the lost episodes. There is more lost Sound Off episodes from 2007 going up this week for Sound Off Legend tier members. So I appreciate all of your support, all of your patronage. It means a lot to me. Follow me on Twitter @Solomonster. And I'm going to be back with you for episode 702. That is coming up next Sunday. Of course, tonight, again, is the big Impact Rebellion main event, champion against champion, title for title. I am sure I will have thoughts on the outcome of that on the Dynamite stream coming up this Wednesday, our final Dynamite stream for the month of April. So let's make it a big one. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. Don't forget, Drew McIntyre's book, you can pre-order it right now on Audible. Get on that. And I will see you guys back here for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
The great Kali. When I think back to all those Kali moments, I mean, we've got the there was the time that he, who can forget that great, you know, how about I just share a story? Big Show sees Khali walk in. He says, "Hey, motherfucker, why do you keep stealing my spots? That's bullshit. You can't even do any of it properly anyway because you're the fucking shits."
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.